the vault of startling monster horror tales of terror.
Hello, monster maniacs. It's your old pal, the Chris Keeper, here. It's getting close to Halloween, so you know it's time for tricks and treats. Here is our first special bonus episode of the Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror. This time, we give you a little break from the standard gru and go for the comedy. With Bud Abbott and Lou Costello meet Frankenstein's monster. But don't let the title deceive you. It really should be Bud Abbott and Lou Costello meet Frankenstein's monster, the Wolfman, Dracula, two conniving women, and a pissed-off Irishman. So sit back and relax as we take you way back into the late 40s for a horror classic.
Hello and welcome to a special Halloween edition of the Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror. This is in addition to our, I guess so far annual Halloween short story, episode. We're throwing in a bonus one this month because that's just the kind of guys we are. And when I say we, I mean myself. I'm Chris Honeywell, and I'm here with Luke Giaconetti and the Hair Metal Hero.
Yeah, we love the sound of our own voices.
Ah, yes.
You know it.
That's what editing is great when I can just sit and listen to my I was editing actually once a couple days ago, and while I was editing a part where there was some confusion as to what was going on, and Scott was listening to another one of his tapes of us talking, and it came in through, sort of similar to what happened with us a little earlier tonight, came in through the computer. And so I'm listening to this recording of us listening to a recording of ourselves. And at the same time, nobody knew Scott was listening to that, and he didn't know it was getting piped in. And it sounded just exact. It was the same people who were talking. So then they started talking again. And then there was the confusion of people starting answering somebody who was in a recording. And then all the confusion. And then I'm just sitting here just like I'm in some sort of hellish echo chamber. But that's like neither here or there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Since it's Halloween, we're bringing the comedy on the horror show.
What?
That's ironic. You would think for Halloween that we would want to bring the bloodiest, horrible, most just horrifying horror movie of all. But that's
we're not reviewing Napoleon Dynamite, so.
That's true. I was just going to say, that's more par for the course for the regular show, so I guess now we're sort of doing a departure into comedy, and I'll say they're probably in the movie. Well, I should say what we're talking about, and that's Bud Abbott and Lou Costello meet Frankenstein, or Abbott and Costello meet Frankenstein, which rolls
off
the
tongue. They don't meet Frankenstein.
Huh? That's exactly right, and very much like as you'll hear later on this month, the movie Monster Squad, even though it's, you know, not actually Frankenstein, by the end of the movie, he's being referred to as Frank. Always a pet peeve of mine.
Mine too.
You know what, though? It's really only in one scene that he gets referred to as Frank.
Yeah, and it doesn't really bother me in this movie because it's Abbott and Costello meet Frankenstein. What do you expect? You kind of need that to happen. And probably in, 1946 that this came out? Or
48.
48? Yeah, it was that joke was probably a lot fresher then, too.
Yeah.
Well, the thing, and the thing that has always, always, always held up about Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein is that this is really the first of the real horror comedies. And why it still works to this day is that there is a, you know, there's two separate things going on here. There's your typical Abbott and Costello kind of slapstick farce, and then there's a Universal monster movie going on, and both of them expect the monster all played exactly like they would in a regular Universal Monsters horror film. There's no difference in the way that, you know, the Wolfman, Dracula, Frankenstein's monster are portrayed here than they were a couple years earlier in House of Dracula. And that holds up so well because it's like, yeah, we got Lou mugging for the camera, but, you know, then Dracula's acting like Dracula. The Wolfman acts like the Wolfman. So, yeah.
Well, it helps that it's Bela Lugosi and Lon Chaney, too, that
this is only the second time that Bela Lugosi ever played Dracula.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
In Dracula, and then in this, he played a couple of
vampires,
but he never had played Dracula again.
Well, I was very surprised at how, once he got going, how loquacious he was, how many lines Dracula had. I expected him to be more of a quiet lurking character, you know, but Bela Lugosi actually got to do some acting in it, so
yeah, it's a good role for him too, because Dracula's really played as the heavy in this
yeah
role. But do we want to give origin stories on this one or no?
Why not?
Sure, why not?
Because I'm pretty sure this may have been the first Universal monster horror movie I ever saw as a kid. Because I'm pretty sure I saw this just on a Saturday afternoon mm-hmm. on tape when I was like 5, and I loved it, loved it, loved it, loved it, and still love it to this day.
I can't tell you exactly how it was, but I was a little kid, and it was on it wasn't on a tape, but it was on cable TV at my grandfather's house. I was there with my father to help fix his chimney, and it was rainy, so it started raining, so we went inside, and my grandfather had cable, which was a big deal, because we lived out in the sticks, and he turned it on, and this was on. And I have such a condensed version of it in my head for a memory of it. And watching it again was amazing because I had forgotten any scene that didn't have to do with monsters. Everything that had the monsters in it was burned into my head. All the other details of it completely gone. All the Abbott and Costello gags that didn't have monsters running around them, gone. So it was like watching an Abbott and Costello movie I'd never seen before, and this, you know, this rush of memories.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's see. I watched this for the first time 2 days ago, so I get to talk about it tonight.
All right. Some fresh eyes on this one.
This is also the first Abbott and Costello film I've ever seen.
Really?
Yeah.
I would have taken you for a fan of Abbott and Costello.
I'm a Stooges guy.
Well, I would have figured that too, but I didn't know. I didn't realize until recently that there was like a little. It was sort of like a Beatles Rolling Stone thing with the Stooges and Abbott and Costello.
Now, having said that, I found it quite enjoyable. If I was about 2 inches taller, I'd probably be a dead ringer for Costello. So.
Well, I remember when I was watching it this time, I was like, Costello really wasn't as heavy.
He's a pretty stocky guy.
He's kind of a stocky guy, but he was little, and the way his frame was built, he was very, you know, I mean, he does a lot of swift little very nice moves of ducking, you know. When he's on the run, he's ducking under stuff and flipping around and stuff.
You know, Lou's the quintessential comedic man child, you know. He's like a little
yes.
You think about a little kid can do that kind of stuff, and that's what Lou's strong suit is. You know, running away in terror whenever a monster showed up.
Well, here was my one moment of horror in the movie when you know, he's like, what has he got that I haven't got? And she's like, it's his brain. And he's just like, and he says something like, or no, it was when he was about to get his brain cut out. And he's like, This brain's served me perfectly well for the last 30 years. And I'm like, really? You're supposed to be 30 years old in this movie? Come on.
I've had this brain for 30 years. It hadn't worked once yet.
Yeah, there's no way he was 30 years old. Yeah, why were they trying to pass him off as 30 years old? You know, that those guys had to be pushing 50, right, by that time.
I'm not sure. But, I mean, you know, knowing Lou, it probably was an ad lib anyway.
Yes.
So. Oh, man. But what's amazing about this film to me is that, again, if you look at it and you look, the previous film for all of the monsters in this movie was House of Dracula, which came out a couple of years previous. And House of Dracula was the last of the what they called the Monster Mash movies for Universal, where they kind of threw all the monsters together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the what's amazing is that the plot of Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, just taking the monster plot, makes more sense than House of Dracula.
Yeah.
We'll just kind of show up at this doctor's house looking for cures, whereas here we've got a narrative with, you know, Dracula wants to put the brain of a simpleton into the Frankenstein's monster so he can control him and the Wolfman's hunting him down. This is a lot more cohesive than what Universal had been putting out.
It's a lot more cohesive, but at the same time, I've always wondered what Frankenstein or what Dracula, and it's the same thing in the movie The Monster Squad. It's like, what do you want Frankenstein for? You're Dracula. Come on. What does Dracula need? You know,
a bodyguard.
Right. A bodyguard who can't even, you know, the Frankenstein monster isn't a very effective henchman. He doesn't move very quickly. He can't catch Abbott and Costello.
Yeah, but if you, you know, say, here, sit on my casket every night until the sun goes down.
That's true.
That's how I'll justify it.
Okay.
But to me, it's always, like I said, it's always worked well on both fronts, and that's why I love it.
Well, I always looked at this as basically, you know, a kid's movie. You know, yeah. It appeals to, it's a horror movie. It's got the monsters in it. Nobody dies. You know, it's
Sandra.
Huh?
Sandra dies.
Oh, that's right. She gets hucked out the window.
Yeah.
That's right.
I love that. I absolutely love it. He's a kid. It's like, holy crap.
He just hucked her out the window. That's right.
Look.
That's her.
Anytime you get to see the Frankenstein monster defenestrate somebody, it's worth it.
That's my note right here is Sandra gets hers.
But, you know, I mean, all the characters are either just completely like the guy who is the, you know, the good guy scientist who actually falls in love with the good pretty girl. He's zero character. He's not developed at all. He's just sort of there the sad thing is they set the whole thing up as, okay, Lou's got two ladies after him, but they're both full of shit. They're both using him for their own means. And they could have at least tossed him a bone and let him have the blonde in this one, because the professor guy was useless. There was no reason to have him in there.
But Lou never gets the girl.
Oh, I know. It's just, it pisses me. And nowadays he would. Nowadays, in an ironic way, he would be the lady killer in like a Farrelly Brothers movie or something. But,
well, just look at any sitcom from the past 20 years. It's the funny fat guy that's got the smoking hot wife.
Yeah. That's who they end up marrying, you know, because although this guy is definitely, like, super, super man-child, but, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, to this day, if I have a bowl of fruit and I pick up a piece of fruit, I say, I wonder if he counted these. That I have my entire life. What if he counted these?
Yeah, that's what's great about all the characters have. It's like setting up wind-up toys and having them knock into each other, you know. Each of the characters just has their own little, you know, quirk that's going to set up a gag in it. That's the whole nature of these, you know. I mean, that's why I loved those farcical comedies from this time period. You had your quote-unquote, like, I guess you would call them more intellectual style or verbal hijinks of the Marx Brothers. And then you had, like, Abbott and Costello and the Three Stooges, who were just your working class, you know, buffoons. And
well, all these guys sprung out of vaudeville.
Yes.
And that was the thing with Abbott and Costello was that vaudeville had to, you had to cover a lot of bases. And they can work slapstick or they can work, you know, verbal type of stuff. There's not a whole lot of verbal gags, and probably the best verbal gag is when it's a chick with, whose bud tells, goes, you got two girls, what if you had a third girl? And he starts describing.
Yes.
I would help you out. Okay, you take Mary, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You get the third one.
My favorite gag, and it was when Lon Chaney Jr. is being super serious, and you don't understand, but when the moon comes out, I'll turn into a wolf. Yeah, you and 20 million other guys, pal.
Well, I like how in front of both women he goes, they're mine. They're both mine. He says it right in front of the women, right to him, you know.
And because both of them are using him, neither says a word about it.
Well, I love it because Abbott is supposed to be the reasonable straight man of the but he comes off as being very mole-like in this, you know. I forgot that in Abbott and Costello people would get, you know, they would slap each other around a little bit, you know. Like the Three Stooges, you know, but he comes off as a real prick in this one, basically. He's just being a bossy prick and he's just like, well, wait a minute. I'm supposed to get the girls, you know. I'm supposed to be the one who's normal. I'm supposed to, you know, when a pretty girl's put into the plot, you know, you're the comedy relief, you know. And he's really pissed off that he's got two girls after him and he's such an idiot.
Well, he gets dumped on the entire time, you know, because you know, people like the professor ignores him completely in one scene. And he's like, look, wait a minute. We're here to pick up the girls. Where are you going? And you know, so I was part and parcel with their stuff. Was that a good straight man will always look, when something really bizarre happens, a straight man has to look a little incredulous. And there's a lot of bizarre things that happen in this movie. So,
well, you know, the thing about it is, when I was a little kid, I didn't find, maybe it was because it was, although this sort of spawned, like, this was when I was watching this, I'm like, oh my god, this is like the origins of Scooby-Doo. This is totally how Scooby-Doo got started, you know, and this was like, wow, kids were watching this and then they grew up to make Scooby-Doo. But I remember, like, when I was a kid, the scene where, you know, he first is by Dracula's coffin and Dracula keeps opening it up and you know, he keeps doing all the, you know, all those wild takes and all the little, you know, scared, you know, ticks, you know, and it keeps escalating, and it's the total Abbott and Costello, where one, you know, where
you're trying to Abbott, candle move,
huh? and Abbott will leave, and then it just he calls him back, and it's just, you know, it's like Bob Newhart with his phone. It's their format. When I was a kid, that stuff used to frustrate me. I was like, this isn't funny at all. When I was watching it now, and it's funny because I think it was made to appeal to kids. As an adult, I'm like, tears are running down my face when I'm watching it. Every time, you know, every little, you know, I love just like Lou Costello's, he'll look over and then there'll be a monster there. And just the look on his face of just like, oh no, no, no. You know, it's just this total like childlike just resignation of like, oh geez, no, it's the Wolfman, you know. It was killing me every little you know, ghost. It works in this so well, you know. I guess maybe because nobody does that sort of stuff anymore.
Right. It's too. Yeah. It's
cartoony, and that's the only place you'll see it now is in the very childish cartoons.
But the thing is, when it's done well, there's and you know, I mean, a lot of it comes from the. Their discipline they got doing vaudeville when you're on stage and doing it live, of, you know, having your timing be out, you know, just snap. And you don't have teams much anymore. You do every once in a while. You have your Penn and Tellers and stuff like that. But when you have teams, they can, you know, they get that, you know, almost psychic connection where they can time out their gags and their sidelong looks. And it's like, you know, it's like watching a band at work, a great band at work or something, you know. And I don't think I appreciated that when I was a kid, you know. I just thought it was dumb humor. And now that I watch it, it's just, you know, the amazing amount of skill and timing put into all, you know, All of that is just great.
And what's always impressed me about the scene in McDougal's House of Horrors, and McDougal's a funny character, and you notice every time McDougal shows up, he's pissed off.
Yeah.
Well, everybody's just a caricature. He's just he's just the angry Irishman who comes in and blah, 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 and he's, you know, that's what they always have in these movies, like a mad dog snapping at their toes, you know, an unreasonable mad dog. It's either their boss, and it's always that actor. That actor was so many heavies in The Little Rascals, it's ridiculous. Yeah.
But in that scene in McDougal's House of Horrors with the, you know, with, are you trying to tell me that candle moved? It's just straight silliness. Silliness the entire time until Dracula is fully revealed when he hypnotizes Lou, mm-hmm. and he gets the monster up and he animates the monster, and now we're solidly in Universal Horror territory. And it's like, if you don't, you know, if that's not Lou Costello playing this shipping agent, if that's just some guy on a Universal contract, this could be a straight horror movie.
Mm-hmm.
The re-animated monster. And it's like, and it switches gears so smoothly from, you know, Lou mugging for the camera being scared to, you know, the monster tearing apart the crate and standing up. And Glenn Strange took over playing the monster in House of Frankenstein. So he played it in House of Frankenstein, House of Dracula, and then this film. And he doesn't get a whole lot to do in the two House films. He gets a lot more to do in this mm-hmm. one. And he looked great. Glenn Strange played a lot of bad guys in Westerns and things of that nature. So he's a big, burly dude, and so he's really well-suited to playing the monster. So when he gets to do some physical stuff, it's really nice.
And his voice is perfect. You know, the yes, master is perfect. You know, it's a pitch-perfect Frankenstein voice.
Yep. So like I said, it keeps that up. It keeps that energy up the entire time as we go from one to the other smoothly. And none of the monsters are treated for a joke.
You know?
They behave normally, and you know, it's Bud and Lou reacting to them that is funny.
Well, it's not until the very end that there's a little bit of slapstick with them, but it's always involving Bud and Lou.
Yeah.
You know, not pushing Frankenstein into a room and,
yeah,
and
it's
stuff
not
like that.
I just recently watched, I've been watching all of the Universal Mummy films, just for my own personal edification and because I love mummies. And I watch Abbott and Costello Meet the Mummy to cap it off. And the mummy in that is a joke. He's treated like a joke. He does a lot of silly stuff. You know, Dracula, the monster, and the Wolfman do not do anything silly in this movie. You know, they stay true to character.
Yeah.
They've got some ridiculous people with them.
Yeah, especially Lon Chaney Jr. I mean, he's committed. I mean, he's doing the same Larry Talbot shtick he did in all the other movies. He just, you know, looks a little bit older.
Yeah, you could tell maybe there wasn't he an alcoholic or something? Or,
yep, he was usually drunk by noon.
Yeah, there was definitely a little bit of alcohol or something in his voice or in his eyes, you know what I mean? That a little bit of the blank stare. But that sort of works with Larry Talbot anyway.
Yeah, it does.
Easy Halloween costume idea for Vault listeners. Go as Larry Talbot. Just wear an ill-fitting shirt. Muss up your hair a little bit and grab people by the lapels, shake them and say, "You don't understand!
It's a full moon!
Lock me in my room, please!"
It's funny how that trope of "please lock me up" has continued through pretty much every good werewolf story. Monster Squad is in there.
It hurts, you know? They did that on Angel, for crying out loud.
Oh yeah, they did. And Buffy.
They did it in the Wolf movie with Jack Nicholson.
Yep.
Jesus Christ, you've been drinking already? Oh, man, that movie sucked. He walks into work and smells the guy's breath, and it's like, how did that guy know I was drinking? Oh, the movie's fucking terrible.
Kisses on the guy's shoes.
That was funny.
Well, in theory, Jack Nicholson as a werewolf is a awesome, awesome thing, but that's, I guess, just
it's almost a little too on the nose, if you
yes, maybe Jack Nicholson is the old man version of Wolverine. That would be fun.
Oh god. Jesus,
want to hear a story, Bob? Come here, sit down.
No, there's only one person that could play old Wolverine: Clint Eastwood.
Ooh, yeah, you're right.
You know what's an amusing credit in this? The animator who did the animated scenes of Dracula changing.
That's what I want to ask you about, Luke. Is this the first time we saw the transformation?
Yes.
I love it.
Yeah, it's the first time we saw the transformation with actually Dracula. I think they did it in Son of Dracula, who's Alucard, which is Lon Chaney.
Was it Carradine in that? Who's that? No.
Carradine was in the Two House movies.
Right, right.
In the Two House movies. But I think I want to say that this is the first time we actually see Dracula animated changing into the bat like that.
Which is awesome.
It is, and it's Walter Lantz, who is credited as the animator. He was Universal's
Woody Woodpecker.
Creator of Woody Woodpecker.
And oh, wow.
That's why I always love the opening credits with the...
Oh, yeah.
On the coffins, and then you have the little parade of the monsters, because it looks like a Woody Woodpecker cartoon.
Yes, it does. Yeah, those skeletons look very old-school cartoony.
Yeah. I always loved that bit as a kid with the monsters and parading across... And then you've got the va-va-voom music at the end for Sandra.
Yeah. And she was pretty va-va-voomy in the cartoon form of it.
Oh, yeah.
And now I look at it and I'm amused because she's the credited with the monsters. And again, if you look at House of Frankenstein, House of Dracula, they all said, oh, it's five monsters in one movie. And the monsters were, you know, Frankenstein's monster, the Wolfman, Dracula, the
Hunchback,
and the Hunchback.
Yeah.
She takes, we don't have a hunchback sort of character, but Sandra takes the role of the mad scientist from the Two House movies. And she is, you know, she's very charming and European when she's with Lou, but then she's a cold, stone cold bitch when she's with Dracula. And it's like, oh man, she's mean.
Yeah.
And he makes reference to all the crazy experiments she did in Europe. And you're like, what the hell did she do? Up with Dracula.
Some sort of Ilsa She-Wolf of the SS sort of thing vibe going with her, yeah.
And it's like, wow, I mean, Dracula is hooked up with this chick, so you know she must have been doing something messed up.
Yeah.
And that note, with the words messed up, let's take a short little break in order to play any short subjects or whatever we... detritus we might have to throw out here. We'll be back in just a second.
Return to the far-flung future of 1969 with another thrilling adventure of Commander Scott Gardner and his flying freaks. Scott Gardner and the Fire Hussies from the center of the Earth. On an exploratory flight over the North Pole, Commander Gardner discovers a hole leading to the center of the Earth.
I have found a hole leading to the center of the Earth.
Commander Gardner and his Flying Freak Brigade embark on a mission to the land of the Hollow Earth, Hussylvania, ruled by the seductive Queen Popo. Explosions! Robots! Giant rocks! Hate-clenching excitement! Will the evil Queen Popo drain Scott Gardner of his vital essence?
You fire hussies will not steal my vital essence.
Along for the adventure, Scott Gardner's trusty sidekick, Pablo.
Hush, Mr. Gardner. There's only one man with a blimp like that. Space Hitler.
Look out!
Will Space Hitler capture the secret weapon of the Hussylvanians before Commander Gardner can stop him? Laugh at the hijinks of the drunken ship's cook, Maury Clawhammer.
Aw, Jesus Christ, I ain't going in no goddamn hole in the ground.
An adventure in 74 15-minute installments. Can your heart take the excitement? Can your mind expand enough to comprehend the storyline? Will you fork over your hard-earned money to see Scott Gardner and the Fire Hussies from the center of the Earth?
Filmed in DimanzoVision.
Are you trying to tell me that candle moved?
Candles can't move.
A moving candle is recycled from Hold That Ghost, and it's weird because I don't know where it's funnier because it's awesome in both movies.
Oh man!
And of course, I think my favorite line in the whole thing is, "You don't believe this, do you? It's just a bunch of bunk." That's what I'm telling you. That is his bunk.
Well, I love that always those scenes always rely upon the straight man never just going over and opening up the coffin. And by the time he does, it's already 10 minutes into the scene when Dracula's fully out of the out of the coffin and lurking in the background. So, you know, it's just the funny thing is, as a kid, it was the obviousness of it that used to bother me, and now as an adult, it's the obviousness of it that makes it that makes much more funny. You know, the stupider that Lou Costello is, the better it gets. You know, the more ridiculous he is, it's just, yeah. I may have to have a little, you know, spell where I watch a bunch of old Abbott and Costello movies and Marx Brothers movies and stuff. Because I forgot, you know, I mean, that stuff it really makes me laugh. Like, it catches me by surprise, you know, because I'm expecting it to be old and sort of tame and stuff. And it is tame, but it, you know, just genuinely hilarious moments.
But it's like modern speed comedy, like joke telling, and you wouldn't expect that from something that's 70 years old.
Yeah, people think of The Simpsons as that one joke after another, and it really it did come from a different time, and dialogue being snappy. They're like, you know, Quentin Tarantino with his snappy dialogue. Well, he's just bringing it back from that time and adding, you know, fuck to it. Basically, you know, and adding some swear words to it, but it's the same sort of thing. You know, it's where you're listening to the product of a writer rather than a writer trying to invisibly, you know, go, you know, create the characters. All the characters are purposeful caricatures, you know, and the dialogue is like, okay, can we write some good, some funny dialogue for it. You know, it doesn't matter whether a real person would say this or not at any point in this movie at all.
Yeah. Any major salient points anybody wants to get to in the second part here?
I want to comment on the fact that you could actually take this as the nail in the coffin for the Universal Monsters, because...
Well, yeah. Yeah, this is when it officially becomes comedy, you know.
No, I mean, not in terms of the thematic. I mean, in terms of the, if you wanted to keep it in continuity, the Wolfman kills Dracula and drowns, even though he survived drowning in one of the House movies, but, and then,
Well, I don't see why that would kill Dracula. I think they left...
in water.
Oh, right.
Well, Hero, go on with what you were saying about how this ties in with the other Universal monster film.
As loose a continuity as those films have, and it is extremely loose. Apparently, they thought people had very short attention spans back then.
Or if just you're didn't put out care.
If you're going to put out a series of films, one a year, I think people would kind of remember the way things end up.
Yeah.
But even playing with the fast and loose continuity that the films have, you could theoretically keep this film in continuity after the two House movies, and House of Frankenstein, House of Dracula, and you could see it as not the end of the characters as legitimate, but literally as the end of the characters in the story.
Mm-hmm.
Larry Talbot grabs Dracula in bat form and presumably is biting him and shredding him on the way down as he jumps out of the window and falls to their demise in the raging waters below.
I also mention that's a great description of a fucking, for the, pardon my French, for the special effects of those days, they pulled that off awesomely.
Yeah.
Usually you see people go off a cliff and they sort of cut away before they hit. The camera watches them all the way down, splash, they hit the water.
Yeah, it's like it's telling you, that's it. I mean, those two are done.
Yeah.
And, I just watched it. I can't remember how the Frankenstein monster meets his demise.
goes on the dock, and the
on the dock is, and they light it on fire. Yeah.
But then you see the dock also. I mean, all this sets itself up to you can cut to the scene of the dock, you know, giving way and Frankenstein monster on fire, just dropping into the water and getting picked up down the shore by, you know,
whoever. Well, I mean, the similar
not
stuff.
With the,
you know,
sorry.
The, go ahead, Hero.
I was going to say, not with those lead boots on. I think he's going right to the bottom.
But, you know, I mean, earlier in the series, like at the end of, I think it's Ghost of Frankenstein, he gets washed away, and then they find him frozen in ice in Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman. So, I mean, the monster can live forever, but I love that scene on the dock with the fire, because it's weird, because it's almost as if the monster has a death wish. Because fire... thing he's afraid of, and he throws the ladder at the fire, and then he goes right into it like he's going after the professor. And that scene always kind of freaked me out a little bit, with the now you've seen it's clearly just a mannequin, but the monster walking through the fire,
mm-hmm.
with catching on fire, that's pretty scary, mm-hmm. looking, you know.
Well, it should be. That's sort of one of the big ultimate scary moments of the movie, so.
Yeah.
And they pulled that off really good. You know, I'm used to the guy in the asbestos suit flailing around, and I was watching this going, hang on, this guy's sort of lingering in the fire too long for an asbestos suit in those days. And I'm like, oh, it's like a puppet dummy. You could tell they were sort of working it, but still, it was creepy as hell.
And yeah, the stiffness of him works, because that's the way Strange played.
Mm-hmm.
The monster's still very stiff and everything. And again, it's comedy and horror right next to each other, because right before that, what do we got? Untie the boat, Wilbur. Untie the boat. Untie the boat.
It's weird. I don't know. I think I've seen Abbott and Costello in The Mummy too, and I think I get a lot of those two movies mixed up. Because I seem to always, like, I was waiting for this one scene in a Frankenstein-like laboratory, but I believe it was in The Mummy, because it was more of a, it wasn't like the big clean white lab in this one. It was more of like a dungeon lab. And I kept waiting for that scene, and I was thinking, well, maybe in my mind the scene with the revolving door, which is just... Yeah. And this is another thing I want to address, is what's funny about the Universal Monsters in this one is there a rule with these guys where they have to come at you slowly?
Yeah.
They just, God. You know, it's like a video, it's literally like a video game in the first couple boards where everything's slow. Like, basically, Abbott and Costello can just sort of run circles through these monsters, and as long as they stay one turn of the door ahead of them,
right.
You know, when they come in the same room. Okay, Frankenstein is understandable. He shambles. So you see Frankenstein, he comes after you at a shamble. The only way he's kind of fast is he's got long-ass legs. But Dracula is superhuman, and Dracula just sort of advances on you, and it's like, well, I can't do anything till I actually physically grab them. So it's all you have to do is stay just sort of out of arm's reach ahead of them and keep a door closing, and you're okay in these comedy monster movies. You know, you'll have Dracula and Frankenstein advancing on you, and you can just keep sort of bumbling ahead of them. And, you know, and the Wolfman, too, that, you know, I mean, Lou Costello pretty much smokes the Wolfman in a race through the woods, you know, to the point of where he doesn't even know it's him. He's like absent. He's not even purposely like smoking the Wolfman and kicking him in the ass and stuff. That's the stuff. Yeah. I always loved that stuff when I was a kid. That stuff always used to get me when, you know, they would think that the Wolfman was just their friend in a mask and start abusing them and doing stupid, you know, really stupid, saying stupid things to, you know, that's the Wolfman standing. I love that shit.
This film also has one of my absolute favorite examples of a classic jump cut gag. When they're in the castle and he gets the phone call from Larry Talbot and he says, "You're in Dracula's castle right now." And it jumps cut to the phone sitting on the desk. and you see Lou Costello running down the hall. He's like steps down the hall already.
Yeah. Oh man.
Yeah, I mean that's always funny. You know, being scared of monsters and mugging out like that, I don't care. That is funny forever because everybody can relate to that.
I wonder if anybody could pull off something like this. Was Ghostbusters maybe the closest thing to what we could get for a modern day equivalent of this?
I don't know. I certainly that one, but I definitely think it could be done again.
I mean, the Monster Squad is definitely sort of, you know, formed off this idea anyway of the, you know, comedy, but that was, you know, made more into a more of a narrative, but.
But there's legitimate peril in that one. I mean, Dracula picks up a six-year-old girl and, you know, calls her a bitch. I mean, it's not.
Yes, yeah. There is really no real peril in this one to any, you know, to anybody except for
no.
The woman who gets hocked out the window.
Yeah, she had it coming.
She totally did.
And what's funny is that was kind of, it wasn't just like straight through the window. She sort of hit the window, it broke, and she just like rolled through. So she probably just bounced off the side of the cliff all the way down.
Oh.
It was probably very painful.
Splat.
And what's funny is that I'd said earlier that Glenn Strange didn't get to do a whole lot in the two House movies, and he gets some action. Well, that scene is not even Glenn Strange. they were filming it. Apparently he got a cable caught on his foot, and he pulled a camera down on his foot.
Ooh.
And so he shoot that day. So that's actually Lon Chaney Jr. Wearing the Frankenstein makeup like he did in Ghost of Frankenstein for that one scene. Look, you can sort of see it, that it looks like Lon. It's hard to tell in the monster makeup, but then the whole chase through the castle and everything is Glenn. And, when the two door gags. First off, classic when they move the bed and everything.
Yes.
And they try to beat the door, and Lou's very confident. He can't get in here now. Door opens out. But and then the next one, when the monster punches through the door, Lou purposely goes off his mark to get hit in the head. So he actually did get socked right.
He
in
got
the side.
Socked in the head, and the monster grabbed a hank of hair. Had his hair in his hat. You could tell he punched through. Got a hank of his hair, and then was probably like, I'm not supposed to have this guy by the hair, and then lets him go. But it's just awesome because the fist is through the door and has his hair in his head. It's like a Three Stooges gag, actually, you know, with the hair getting grabbed and stuff. And yeah, and the look on Lou Costello's face is just priceless. I mean, it's such an obvious gag. It's sort of obviously coming. Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
That almost the fact that it is an obvious gag makes it even funnier in that context.
And then, right, and then right after that, the monster stomping down the door is has been since I was a kid one of my absolute favorite Frankenstein monster scenes.
Yeah, it's a pretty cool scene.
Stomping it down, it's like, oh, geez, he is mad. and again, I've said it a dozen times, but when you play the monster stuff straight. You know, that's why it keeps up and it works good, and it's not making fun of Frankenstein's monster. So even if you're just a Frankenstein fan, you can watch this and enjoy that aspect of it, you know.
Well, another thing on just a sheer visual level, like, you know, I mean, visually, a lot of the Abbott and Costello stuff at the beginning, you know, when they're at the mailroom and stuff like that, it's just your standard Abbott and Costello stuff. It looks like it was lit on a set and stuff. But once the monster movie element comes in, it gets that beautiful. And what's funny is the version that I watched it on wasn't as what I think sort of spawned all this is you put the clip up of the like last 5 minutes of or just the 5 minute chunk of their chase through the house to where the wolfman goes off the balcony with Dracula. And that clip was in HD. Or was in, you know, really high definition. I blew it up on the screen, and I was just like, wow, this is so gorgeously filmed. You know, the matte paintings are beautiful. The lighting is so moody and, you know, just beautifully lit. You know, you see the reason why black and white film was actually used sometimes instead of color film, you know, because of just the denseness of the detail in it and everything. And they didn't cheap, even though this is the comedy turn for your Universal Monsters, they didn't cheap out on the look of it at all. They didn't, you know, make it campy and all that. The castle on the island is every bit as creepy as any other Frankenstein castle, and is moodily lit with, you know, fog and of course you've got your standard rubber bats too. I always love seeing rubber bats. That was I love rubber bats.
Yeah, you're right. It's you know, and as I said, in fact, it's almost a step up in quality from at least House of Dracula. House of Dracula,
yeah,
kind of the black sheep, because it's really just a rehash of House of Frankenstein
with recycled footage.
Yeah, whereas this is, you know, this is all new stuff, and there's some more creative takes here. And Lou Costello hated this movie when he first read the script. He said that his daughter could write better crap than this. But he warmed up to it while they were filming it, and to the end that he actually enjoyed doing it. He was him and Glenn Strange apparently hit it off real well. And the whole scene where Lou is sitting on the monster's lap.
Yes.
Apparently they had to film that over and over because he kept glibbing and he kept cracking Glenn Strange up.
Well, it was hilarious. I mean, it's hilarious when he realizes there's another hand. And then once again, he gets that look of horror, like complete horror and denial. And, you know, it's like this horror, but this resignation of like, oh, God, why me again? There's a monster here. And then it's like, okay, there's another hand there. I have to prove it to myself. So he starts, you know, he'll hit it and then he'll be, you can see him just going, oh, God, I don't feel it. You know, and just doing it over and over again. And, you know, you gotta figure a lot of that was ad-libbed or exaggerated upon or, you know, added on to. And it's, you know, it's like being when you have to be the monster sitting there and not moving, all of a sudden you're Harvey Korman, you know, on the Carol Burnett show with Tim Conway,
yeah,
pecking at you, you know. And, yeah, that... it just cracks me up thinking of that stuff. And it's funny, I used to just roll my eyes over that stuff as a kid, just like, although it worked for me in Scooby-Doo.
Yeah, the only thing this was missing people. Was the only thing this was missing was Costello jumping into Abbott's arms.
Yeah. I'm very surprised that didn't happen, actually, because I'm sure they were capable of that of that gag and had done it before.
So Hero, as a first time viewer and a first time Bud and Lou viewer, what did you take away from this? Are you gonna track down more Bud and Lou? And
I think so. I think I gotta increase my knowledge, because I only recently I got introduced to the Marx Brothers as well, and my pants laughing.
Yeah. Oh my God, the Marx Brothers are like, I save the Marx Brothers when I want to watch like the diamond of comedy, you know what I mean? It has every, I mean, there's jokes in the Marx Brothers that are so rude, so
yeah,
insanely rude, and there's so much like sexual humor in it, but it's all very, very intelligently, you know, put on a level to get past the censors. And yeah, I mean, Groucho is a force of nature. Groucho is like one of my all-time heroes. He's just one of the funniest human beings. I mean, all of them are. I mean, Harp, you know, what can you say about Harpo?
Yeah.
his facial reaction.
I just watched, what was the one where Groucho's the president of the country? Is that Duck Soup?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Harpo is a Harpo's. I can't remember if he's there's two popcorn stands, and I can't remember if he's, you know, competition to the other popcorn guy. But he just goes in, and he's such an, he just completely fucks with this popcorn selling guy, just for no reason, just trying to make the guy angrier and angrier. You know, he keeps taking his leg and putting it through the guy's arm and just ruthlessly just, you know, tearing down it. I can't watch those movies without, you know, I literally have to have tissues nearby to wipe up the tears going down my face. What is the Abbott and Costello movie where they go up in the spaceship and they come down in Mardi Gras?
Abbott and Costello Go to Mars.
Go to Mars. That's another one I watched. I think it was probably a double feature with this one because I remember watching it at my grandfather's on a rainy day. That's another one worth seeking out. I've got a Super 8 sort of, you know, miniature version of that one.
Yeah. I mean, there's, you know, going straight through the line, I mean, from their service comedies, which were their first, several of their first couple of films. The first film that they made, that they appeared in, was called a film called One Night in the Tropics, where they're not the stars. They're actually hitmen for a mobster. It's kind of a screwball farce. But their first starring film was Buck Privates, and then they did In the Navy, Keep 'Em Flying. They did all their service comedies, and those are good. Some of their early stuff is really strong. When you get after Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, that's when you get into what's generally called the meat films. You know, we get Abbott and Costello Meet the Killer, Abbott and Costello Meet the Invisible Man, you know, Meet Captain Kidd, Meet Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, Go to Mars, Meet the Keystone Cops, you know, all these sorts of things. And then we were getting away from kind of the, you know, they were kind of really set into a good routine,
yeah.
You know? Whereas some of the earlier films, they're still trying to push, okay, well, we got to have a main, you know, another hero to be the main character to get the girl, and we got to have, you know, a couple of musical numbers in here, because, you know, that was what the comedies were,
right?
Then in the
it was like a vaudeville production, you know, a little bit of everything for everybody.
I mean, just straight through the line you could find quality stuff. And even the two films in 1946 they made when they didn't like each other which were Little Giant and The Time of Their Lives, where they don't play partners. They just play two. There are two characters
in the movie.
In The Time of Their Lives, they appear on screen together like once, which is amazing. But, you know,
did somebody sleep with someone's wife or something, or what happened there?
Just they had a falling out, and they, you know, they had to work together because of their contract, but they didn't want to work together, so they did these types of films, and then they had it was a money thing. And then they reconciled, and then they went on to you know, do the rest of their films together. So, but I mean, if we want to do an Abbott and Costello podcast, that would be the best thing ever. We'll drive my wife up the wall because she doesn't like them. But
I think just a comedy teams podcast would be fun. You know, Abbott and Costello. You could go right back to Laurel and Hardy. There's even some obscure, you know, proto Laurel and Hardys that didn't get as far that were pretty good too. You know, there were all these people that came off of, and a lot of times I would think of them as copying Laurel and Hardy or Abbott and Costello or the Marx Brothers. But then you never know; they might have been around before them. You never know who copied who and who got what from who. But yeah, I mean, that's something. I mean, what was the last? Cheech and Chong, I think, were the last that we really, like, had. I mean, it was, like, Richard Pryor and Gene Wilder were sort of turning, like, into they could possibly
the guys that
duo.
The guys that did Super Troopers and Club Dread and Beer Fest are kind of trying, I think, take that mantle and run with it.
Yeah, but they're too big. They're more of an ensemble, like the Kids in the Hall or something like that, you know? Although I can't wait to see whatever they come up with next. I've liked every one of their movies. The only movie of theirs I didn't really care for was Puddle Jumper. Their first movie was...
Well, it's such a student film.
Yeah. They definitely didn't find their legs, but by Super Troopers they found their legs.
Oh, yeah.
But there isn't like a comedy duo you know, maybe they could have developed the Dumb and Dumber movies into... something like that, but those two guys were too big on their own to form a comedy team, you know? I mean, you got Penn and Teller are sort of like that, but, you know, but they're more of a live magic show. They did a movie, actually, that's very good, very 80s, but...
Yeah.
Well,
I wonder if that could come back.
It everything's cyclic, so I will say this: if any of our listeners want to watch get introduced to Abbott and Costello, a good one to start with, for a multitude of reasons, is a film from 1949 called Africa Screams. And Africa Screams is a jungle safari type of comedy. And besides Abbott and Costello, it also has Joe Besser, who would go on to be one of the later Stooges, and the man he replaced in the Three Stooges, Shemp Howard, is also in it.
And it has a guy in a gorilla suit in it. And that is like always one of my favorite things. Like Abbott and Costello and the gorilla gags in that one it's definitely like the early version of the monsters, you know, except with a gorilla.
And the beautiful thing about Africa Screams is that this was they had a deal in their contract with Universal that allowed them to make, I think it was either one or two independent films. It was one independent film for each cycle of films they made with Universal. This is what the independent film they made during this period, and so it is now in the public domain. So if you go to archive.org and put in Africa Screams, you can get the full movie. So it's a good, you know, way. It doesn't, you know, don't need to go through Netflix, don't need to rent anything, you can just watch it.
You could probably go to YouTube and it would be on there too, probably a million times.
Yeah. And besides, you get Joe Besser, and there's something inherently funny about Lou Costello and Joe Besser on screen together. Besser would be a regular on the Abbott and Costello show that they would do when they finished with their movies, and he plays pretty much the same character that Joe Besser always
played. So, I forgot all about the Abbott and Costello show. I used to see reruns of that when I was a little kid.
Yeah, and then you throw Shemp in there, and I've always liked Shemp. I mean, I like Kurt, but Shemp is a favorite of mine. So
now am I wrong, or wasn't Shemp like part of the Three Stooges before Curly was? Before they started making movies and stuff, wasn't Shemp like?
Yes.
Curly replaced Shemp at some point. So Shemp was really the original when he came back.
Yeah, that is true. Before they started doing their shorts, Shemp was part of the bit.
Yeah, Shemp, I like Shemp. Shemp has that, and he was a lot of the stuff disturbed me as a kid, but it cracks me up now. The thing about these like sort of 40-year-old guys with the long greasy hair. And I think they grease their hair down so when they would slap each other, that it would flop around more visually, and that it was also something that like looked a lot more savage when you would grab a hank of someone's hair and it would be all greasy. It just made them seem like kind of repulsive people, which ramped up the comedy. I don't know. Maybe it was just something about the hairdos of the day, but it seemed like. Moe and Shemp, you know, when they would get a blow across their face, you know, and their comb over would just flop from one side to the other or something, you know, it was just awesome.
Yep. But, I you know, like I said, I've been watching Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein since I was a little kid, and I watched it cut like last week, and I'm still busting out laughing. Still busting out laughing to it after almost 30 years of watching it. It still makes me laugh, and that to me is a testament of a comedy. Again, if you know all the jokes in it and it still makes you laugh, you know, that's got to be something that's worth watching.
I was very surprised when you put up that video how many people, you know, piped up and said, "I love that movie. I remember that movie. I love that movie." So, I'm very surprised, you know, pleasantly surprised by that, and hopefully this'll get some more people to go and check it out. And I'll bet you they could find Abbott and Costello versus Frankenstein on the YouTubes too.
It is available for streaming on Netflix if you belong. So because that is where I watched it this time. I have it on VHS.
And this is an excellent one if you have kids too.
Oh yeah.
You know, and it can even be. Pretty much little, you know, kids of any age are going to be good to go on this one.
Yeah. Because it's silly. And there's monsters, but they're not too scary.
It's not too violent, you know. I mean, I don't know. I'm not a parent. So, you know, I maybe am less, you know, and I also am biased because I did, you know, whether my parents try, you know, my parents, like every other parents, or most other parents, didn't let me see a lot of stuff, but that didn't stop me from seeing, you know, violent and scary stuff, maybe younger than I should have. But I've always thought that kids, once they get to a certain age, you know, that's kind of a little healthy to give them some of the visceral, yeah. The visceral end of it. But they're not going to get it from this at all. You know, the worst bit of violence is a woman getting hucked out the window, and at least and you don't see her fall down, and everybody else that gets destroyed is a monster.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But this, again, it's the perfect introduction to watching the Universal Monster movies, which really, in my opinion, that if you're a parent, your kid has interest in monsters, that's where you got to start.
Yes.
Because are, you know, those are not only the classics, but again, there's nothing real questionable about them. There's nothing, you know, that's going, there's nothing inappropriate, that sort of thing. And watching this, I can, you know, it's totally reasonable to say, oh, well, you know, remember we watched that and had the Frankenstein monster? You want to see more of him? Yeah, I want to see more of the monster, you know. So then you throw on some James Whale, you know, and that gets you going in that direction. You start appreciating it. Oh, he's actually, you know, he's a tragic guy. He's not just a big lumbering monster.
Yeah, I could see Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein being two excellent. Dracula, nah, not so much as like for the little kids, just because it's kind of slow.
Yeah, it's very much a chamber piece.
Yes, it's very much based like on a stage play, but yeah, like Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein are two just great, you know, early horror movies to show your kids that aren't toothless, but they aren't going to traumatize them either. They aren't, you know, bloodbaths. Not, yeah. Andy Warhol's Frankenstein.
No.
Oh, that movie's fucked up.
Hey, in order to know life, you must first fuck death through the gallbladder.
Yeah, I'll pause, thanks.
Everybody knows that.
The thing I love about that movie is the accents.
Yes.
Between the guy who ends up becoming the monster and Joe D'Alessandro,
like, from New York City. Well, my favorite is in Andy Warhol's Dracula. There's a Joe D'Alessandro scene with these ladies, and they're like,
"Yeah,
he's something like, well, he's a cultured gentleman." He's like, "Then what's he doing here with you whores?" And it's like set in Eastern Europe, and everybody else has the thick head. Here he is, just like, "Hey, I'm walking here."
Oh, it's so bad.
One of my greatest experiences was seeing Andy Warhol's Frankenstein on the big. They shipped in the special lenses to show an original print of it in 3D. And Halloween night, I went out. I rode my bike to the theater and got my glasses, and the guy came to introduce the film. He came out dressed as Dr. Frankenstein with the heart on the end of a pike that he hung over the audience, and it was like real cow heart. Hung it out over the first row and gave his whole, you know, introduction, his scholarly introduction to the movie. And then when the movie was over, I was getting on my bike and getting ready to leave, and I see him coming out the side door of this, it's where George Eastman, it's like George Eastman's old estate. So it's like a theater and a series of buildings, but it's, you know, kind of an old rich person's estate. And he comes walking out the side door with the heart on the stake, and he goes, "Kitty, kitty, kitty, kitty." And this cat comes out of the bushes and drops the heart on the ground. The cat's like, "Ah," and like grabs onto this cow heart and goes running back off into the bushes. And I'm like, this is the greatest Halloween ever. That was awesome. But yeah, parents, no Andy, if it has Andy Warhol in the title, if it has Abbott and Costello in the title, you're doing okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like I said, and just as if you got this at kids interested in monsters, this is a good safe way to introduce it. You know, you don't try and pick and choose through the modern stuff, because we don't get any types of movies like this anymore, where monsters are just monsters.
I'm thinking, you know, in modern remake days, let's sell out and write the script for Andy Warhol's Abbott and Costello versus Frankenstein.
Oh my god, why does that sound like there's going to be some sort of homosexual
chick
relationship between Abbott and Costello there then?
No, it would be I would have Lou Costello being like the Joe D'Alessandro character who gets to like sleep with all the Euro you know, the fleshy, hairy Euro babes in it. And yeah, I don't know. We'll have to think about that. But hey, there you go, guys. Coming soon. And the sad thing is, if we don't do it, somebody else probably is going to soon enough.
So we might as well get paid for the motherfucker.
Exactly. And we'll get John Carpenter to produce it, and it'll be John Carpenter's Andy Warhol's Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein.
In sense around.
In 3D sense around.
Spike Lee joint.
A Spike Lee joint. Do you ever find yourself going to Amazon.com and buying some record or movie or some stupid thing that Two True Freaks have been talking about so that you can catch up on it, or you've been reminded of it or something? Well, now, how about this? Instead of going to Amazon.com, go to twotruefreaks.libsyn.com and follow our link to Amazon.com. When you do that, if you buy something over at Amazon, we get a little cut out of it, which is awesome because we love money and it won't cost you a thing.
Did you know? You can sponsor an episode of this or any other of your favorite Two True Freaks affiliated shows. That's right. Simply click the PayPal link on our website, donate any amount at all, tell us which show you're choosing and what message, if any, you'd like us to read on your behalf, and you will be an official sponsor of that show's very next episode, with your message read in the show's opener. It's that easy. And there is no minimum donation. Be a show sponsor today. Visit our website at twotruefreaks.libsyn.com. Two True Freaks is always spelled TWOTRUEFREAKS. Libsyn is spelled LIBSYN.
You can email Two True Freaks directly at twotruefreaks@gmail.com.
Join our forum at forumforgeeks.com, where you can discuss all of the shows on our feed with us and your fellow listeners.
You can find Two True Freaks on Facebook. Just search for Two True Freaks.
And hey, you can friend me, Scott Gardner, on Facebook, too. My name is spelled S-C-O-T-T-G-A-R-D-N-E-R.
You can friend me on Facebook, too, if you can find me.
Now available, Two True Freaks t-shirts. See our website for details.
Two True Freaks is a very proud member of the Comics Podcast Network. You can check that out at www.comicspodcast.com, where you can hear our new episodes when we put them up.
We are also members of the League of Comic Book Podcasts. For more information, visit comicbooknoise.com/league.
If you ever leave your house and you actually have friends, why don't you tell them about Two True Freaks? Thanks for listening.
And join us every Monday for new episodes of
Two True Freaks.